and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting chef, writer, and raconteur Valentine Warner to learn more about his diaristic new cookbook. That's diaristic.
I wonder what you said then. Then we'll be discussing the secret grease that keeps the very wheels of Westminster spinning. That's gossip, listeners.
And we'll be hearing how one of the world's most iconic recording studios is securing its legacy over the coming decades.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news today. And we've music coming your way too, here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Good to see you, Tom.
Good to be here. Nowhere I'd rather spend my Sunday lunchtime.
Looking
here.
Hale and hearty, can I just say?
Very much so.
Glad to hear it. What a week.
It's been very busy. Can I tell you one of the things I was most intrigued to hear about this week here at Monocle Towers?
Yes.
It was the report provided to me by our own Fernando Augusto Pacheco, from whom we'll hear momentarily, about what he'd been up to in France this week.
And what was that, to bypass the horse's mouth?
It was a very exciting, I'm going to say, revelation from our friends at Chanel. We've been doing lots of exciting work with them recently, and they are celebrating the métier, those makers. They're celebrating the art of sort of local specialist manufacture in a quite extraordinary facility in the environs of Paris. More will be revealed. Our editor-in-chief, Tyler, was writing about it this week. More will be revealed in due course on our airwaves. But what I like about that is it's a celebration of the art of doing, making. Something that I think more people would be well served to pay attention to.
Indeed. Can I just say, about bloody time, sick of those mass-produced garments and items.
That way a happy life does not lie, Org.
Hark! Do you hear a knocking at your chamber door?
It's the Archangel Fernando, and he's come to bestow upon us the gifts of foresight.
Fernando, bless us. There was something.
Hello, guys. Well, just back from Paris, you know.
We were just talking about the same Fernando.
To be honest, quite a shame, actually, because this weekend, you know, it's quite lovely weather in Paris. When I was there, it was amazing visiting this M19, this new Chanel, where all the kind of workers at Chanel will be there working, collaborating. But it was raining quite a lot.
Did you have a parapluie?
No.
Ah, mon Dieu.
I never had one. But I wonder, guys, how's the weather in Poland today, actually?
Take us there, Fernando.
Because that's my first story. Today is the parliamentary elections in Poland. They're voting for the 460 members of parliament and 100 for the Senate. Even though there are not big surprises here, because I think the Law and Justice Party will win again with their ultra-conservative message. But the interesting thing here, apparently 4 years ago, the main message was kind of anti-immigration. But now, guess who are they after? The gays, the LGBT community, I think they're attacking. And it's interesting, there's been a poll in Poland for men under 40. What are their main worries? And apparently the main worry was the LGBT agenda.
Wow.
So it's still very much conservative.
How is that manifesting itself for all these worried younger male polls? What are they so concerned about?
It's very concerning. But then I was reading, the opposition civic platform. They would probably poll around 25%. But I think they're quite underwhelming. And the thing with the Law and Justice Party, they have a generous, welfare state as well. So I don't think people are voting just because they're anti-gay as well. There's something behind. The economy in Poland actually has been, growing quite, systematically through the years. So there are other reasons. But it's a shame because they are very much ultra-conservative.
And there's an irony to their name, of course, the Law and Justice Party, because they keep having these set-tos. They try and restrict and regulate the judiciary. Maybe we should have changed their party nomenclature.
Where are we going next, Faye?
Well, next, something closer to home. Today is the end of the BFI London Film Festival and the film they chose to end the festival. By the way, let me tell you something. It's not, the most glamorous film festival, but I do think it's getting better, through the years. There's no glamour, but they're all the films that you need to watch for the Oscar season. They're there.
There's no competitive element, though, is there? It's not like Venice or Berlin where there's a big fanfare for the best film. It's purely hey, consumers, come and see the great stuff that's coming up.
There are some awards, like for the first feature, but you're right, it's not as competitive as
maybe
the other.
Is it a little better for that? It's a real celebration of film.
Actually, it's good for residents of the city. I mean, because, you know, it's literally everywhere. Everywhere. It's at the BFI, at the more commercial cinemas as well in Leicester Square. And, you know, I did enjoy quite a few films. But by the way, I just have to tell you, the film that will end today with the gala is The Irishman. You know, the Martin Scorsese film that everybody's talking about. I guess if you're a fan of Scorsese, you will enjoy this film.
I'll be watching it at home next week when it comes out on Netflix.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that actually.
Very adjacent. Mm.
But for festivals, I like to watch foreign films that I know might not be released here in the UK, because I think, especially in the UK in the last years, there have been less indie films kind of being released, especially foreign films like French films, Spanish, which I think it's a shame. But I had two highlights. I saw a Dutch psychosexual thriller called Instinct. That's the Dutch entry for the Oscars next year as well. It's quite heavy, you know, the film in some ways, but very interesting. I think that will be my tip. And also I saw Bacurau, which is a Western sci-fi social drama Brazilian film, which I enjoyed very much. It's a bit crazy, you know, and it's also a critique of the current Brazil under Bolsonaro. Yeah, so Instinct and Bacurau.
Crazy Brazilian social commentary or psychosexual thrills? I'm going to make you choose.
You know what? I'll go for the psychosexual thrills.
Every time, Fernando.
I could have guessed that.
Is there time for anything else?
Yeah, very important. I mean, this week is the Frankfurt Book Fair. I've been there. It's fascinating. I mean, the amount of distributors. I think there's 7,200 exhibitors from 100 countries. And the interesting thing, every year they choose a country as a guest of honor.
I was going to say, what's the focus this time around?
Norway. And I've been reading here, apparently the Norwegians are the European nation that reads the most. So it makes sense that they're the guest of honor. So, of course, they have classic authors like Henrik Ibsen and Knut Hansen, but also modern ones, even Jo Nesbø, of course, which is, you know, a massive hit here in the bookshelves in the UK. So it's going to be a very interesting Buchmesse
and
this
will
year.
Carl Ove Nausgaard be there?
Yes, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned his name because I was struggling. But definitely.
Yeah. And we'll be complete without him.
So I think Norway is quite an interesting country when it comes to literature. And next year's guest of honour will be Canada, which I think will also be very interesting.
What's nice about that is that at the moment, you know, in the last couple of years, translation has kind of come into the spotlight in the literary world in a way that I think it hasn't before. You know, there's been this sense that a translation is the book in its original language, but in a new language. And now people are waking up to the artfulness of the form. And I think that's really going to start Anglophone readers developing a new relationship with foreign literature.
I certainly hope so. And I think last year their guest of honor was Georgia, which, you know, unlike Norway, I think it's, you know, their literature is less well known. So I think the Buchmesse also opens the opportunity, as you say, for more Georgian authors to be translated.
And we should direct our listeners to this programme, to the whole range of Monocle books, which of course are available in all good bookstores now, or online, wherever you happen to be.
And our very own Marie-Sophie Schwarzes, she'll be there in Frankfurt covering the event for us.
So find her, say hello.
Do pop along and say Morgans. Thank you, Fernando. Good to see you. Thanks for popping in this Sunday. You're with the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be hearing about not literary, but culinary communication with Valentin Warner. Regular listeners to Monocle 24 will know that the menu is where we tend to park most food-related items. Our next guest, however, surely belongs right here on the Weekly. Yes, Valentin Warner is a chef, but it's not just his food that's rich. His recipes offer more than guidelines for cooking. They offer anecdotes, observations, and real insight.
In his new book, The Consolation of Food, Valentin presents a handful of recipes alongside a much bigger handful of reminiscences. Part memoir, part diary, and part cookbook, it's a literary manifestation of the associative power of food. Proust, eat your heart out. I caught up with Valentin to learn a bit more about it. Valentin Warner, thanks so much for joining me for the Monocle Weekly to talk about your really remarkable new book, The Consolation of Food. There's lots to unpack, but I think the most pressing question is to tell me about pig vagina tacos.
That was something I ate in Mexico City. And a few years later, I found myself talking to a very staunch officer class of the WI about a kind of a, you know, a young life in food. it all went extremely well. And then at the end, one of them said, tell us the strangest thing you've ever eaten is. And I said, I don't think that's appropriate, which only kind of baited them more. You know, I had to deliver at this point. So I said, well, it would be the pig's vagina tacos I ate in Mexico City. The whole room went quiet. Then telling a second truth, I followed it up, and really to fill the terrible silence that fell across the room, it was tender and giving, and I ordered another one. And anyway, needless to say, I didn't get any sherry. They can go either way, the WI. They're either all in or they're all out. And
I
this
can
was
imagine.
Very much a case of all out.
You might hope that they'd be a little bit bawdier than that. I bring that up just because this is one of the many stories that you tell in The Consolation of Food. And it's strung together with these references to the other stories. It's kind of a nice web, if you like, that describes your life in food. How did you kind of decide that now is the time to write this? It's an unusual book.
Somebody said the other day, you know, what's the book about? And in a very flippant moment, I said, it's a book about chaos theory. And what I really meant was my life is quite chaotic in the way, you know, that I go about it. Quite a lot of the book deals with a very stressful time I had. In a way, it's the kind of luxury of being 47 and being able to do a brain dump in order that I can actually move off for the second part of my life with an empty vehicle, so to speak.
Nice. So it's a kind of catharsis.
There's catharsis in a way, and also, you know, when you collect a lot of things, they're down now and they're out, and it's an exercise in filing, and also fun as well, and, you know, as you said, cathartic. That's a very jumbled answer, but then so's the book, I guess.
Well, quite. When you were writing it, was it something that you spread out over a while? Were you sitting down and these snippets, they're diaristic, they're reminiscences. Were you just finding time here and there just to write a few notes?
The book went on for actually longer than it was meant to. There was quite a lot going on. I find it very hard to sit still, apart from anything. It was quite a drawn-out process. I'd slightly bitten off more than I could chew when I was writing it. But I think it sorted itself in a way. I have to carry things around for a long time and slowly bits fall away. That's what I was kind of left with. And I think there's a few things that, you know, maybe I think, actually, I wish I had put that in. But I guess that's every book finishes. Potential ongoing problem.
Alongside these kind of diary entries, it would be sad if there weren't. There are some really excellent recipes. At the front, you describe the process of recipe writing as a bit of a faff.
I cook in a very, it's second nature. Mm. It's my currency. It's the alphabet I understand. I can't write music. I don't understand spreadsheets particularly well. But food I do, so it's kind of second nature to me, cooking. Writing recipes is a pain because you can't write a flick of this and a flick of that because you have to be quite precise, which I find it's not the way I cook. But and so I think it was nice that the book reversed the other way around because in my previous cookbooks, it was actually the stories I'd really enjoyed writing and the recipes I found incredibly hard. And this, my publisher said, they didn't say, they said, you know, write a storybook with some recipes in. So that was perfect for me because that's the bit I'm really interested in. It's not the plate of food as such, although it's often memorably delicious things. But I guess I'm more interested in the people, the place, the situation, the smells in the air, all the other bits that actually find yourself sitting in front of that plate of food. So it was lovely to write a storybook rather than a cookbook. It was quite tough, some of it. I've spent a very long time grieving my father. And I think in writing this book, actually, I finally kind of said goodbye. And I'm not you. And I know you're sitting up there with your legs dangling off the rings of juniper, drinking a martini and looking down at me, and none of my silly flappings down here mean anything anymore, but we're different, and I've spent a life trying to be like my dad. And he was occasionally in the room when I was writing it, and I kind of look up actually every now and again and say kind of hi, I know you're there. But that was quite an important thing actually for me, which was to, I've kind of parked that one now. Yeah.
When did food become this important emotional or relational thing for you? Has it always been like that? Or did being a chef kind of induce that? When did the language of food...
The language started, I think, the minute I kind of came screaming into this. You know, I kind of grew up in rural Dorset in the 70s. My father was a passionate lover of wildlife and nature, and we lived on a farm. He was a diplomat, but we had a dairy farm in Dorset where I grew up. As a child, I seemed to bite everything. Table legs, people, oil paint. Constantly, I kind of understood the world through my mouth. Having a mother who was an endlessly brilliant cook who wouldn't go shopping, she'd just open a tin and find some withered lettuce in the fridge and make something delicious. And then a father who kind of animated nature and put it in his pockets and brought it home and put it on toast. Then very soon the world for me was divided into edible or inedible. when we travelled, we ate in a lot of wonderful places, family meals. If my brother got an extra chop at the table, he'd kind of wink at me in victory, which would make me furious. And there was always lots of parties and lots of people, and very much based around food and a lot of cooking. Cooking was a massive thing in my family. It still is. We row across the table, we talk across the table, we drink across, you know. It's a Warner family life has happened, you know, when we were all living together, is three times a day around the table. It was a central point of our house. So it started incredibly young. And then I went to art college, which, and again, it was also a different kind of organization of shapes and colors. I like making things with my hand. And food is the same. So I always thought about food when I was art college, draw art while I do food. Food won out in the end. You do everything and then one wins and food won in the end.
You're spending a lot of time in Norway. Tell me about that.
An extraordinary thing happened about 4 years ago. A woman called Ingen Rasmussen, what a great name, rang me up and said, she was working in Korea, had been watching my programs on television, said to me, and it made me laugh, I probably know more about your programs than you know about them, and I'd like to invite you to Norway. I initially said, I can't go, I'm a bit busy at the moment. And then I spoke to her again, and I thought, this woman is really funny, and she's really intelligent, and there's just something about her I find quite beguiling. And so she said, I'm sending you an air ticket. So I went, and I arrived at this tiny airport, Leknes Airport, and then driven through this heart-stopping countryside. I mean, breathtaking. And also I've spent, you know, a childhood growing up fascinated by splintering monastery doors and Vikings and trolls and deep, dark woods with moss and stuff in them. So I always kind of wanted to go there, make the series, which she sees, and then suddenly end up going to her set of cabins. So we sit and we drink lots of aquavit and we walk and eat a lot of cod. And she says at the end, do you want to be kind of involved in this place? And I was going, well, I'd be mad to say no. I mean, how often does this kind of job come along? I couldn't invent it if I tried. And it's got fishing too. And so then I went back to her and said, look, it should be driven by great chefs who can really respond to the natural larder around them. We'll get the world's great bartenders up here. And then we'll have speakers and we'll have knife makers. We've got one of the animators from Aardman coming up next year to do plasticine workshops in the snow, while Nieves Barragán is going to be cooking cod. As I always say, I'm kind of floating on my analog in a digital sea. And so I guess even though I'm tapping away my Instagram up there, most of the time I'm walking up a hill or picking mushrooms or talking to people cooking. So the idea is to get people up to this place where, you know, nature is our default setting. This is super nature up there in the most overwhelming and profound way, where people come up and they eat a lot, they drink quite a lot too, but then there's wonderful things to go and do and to kind of go home feeling, well, I've used my hands, I've used, you know, my mouth a lot. It's a wonderful place and it does great things to the people who come so far. They all kind of leave with tears in my eyes going, this kitchen on the edge of the world experience is a wonderful thing. So we've got a lot of scope to do a lot of things, but Holmen Loften, which is where it is, it's a wonderful thing. And I think of all the things that I care about happen there. And I guess I love London. It's a great city, but as I come back to it from there, I do get a sinking feeling.
Thanks to Valentine. And the consolation of food is out now. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first-ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in the Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
Now, it's obvious to even the most casual observer that whatever is meant to be happening in the heart of the UK's Parliament in Westminster is not happening correctly. As the whole thing collapses, however, it's maybe worth taking a slightly closer look at the foundations on which it's built.
Marie Leconte, a freelance political journalist, has done just that. In her new book, Haven't You Heard?, she offers an engaging survey of one of the more underreported cornerstones of Westminster, gossip. From the delicate and sometimes problematic relationship shared between politicians and the press to the notorious discretion or indiscretion of clerks, she examines a mechanism that doesn't get as much of an airing as perhaps it should.
Marie, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Great to have you with us. And congratulations on Haven't You Heard, which is a salacious and also fascinating read. How did you arrive at a book describing Westminster gossip? What alerted you to the need for that?
So I'm a political journalist now, but I had a slightly unconventional route into it in that. So I've never been a lobby journalist, by which I mean I've never, worked for one of the national papers, just doing the political news of the day. I came in through the Evening Standard Diary. So I worked at the Londoner's Diary desk back in 2015. I ended up there slightly randomly, found myself really, really enjoying it. Like, it's a very, very fun job. And from there, kind of organically found myself writing more and more about politics. And I had a very kind editor, Joy Lodico, who I believe actually is a friend of Monocle's, but eventually said, listen, do you just want to do like political gossip full time? And I was like, yes, please. Because she was like, also as a side note, you don't really know anything about anything else and you're quite bad at getting stories on like arts and entertainment and literature and stuff. I was like, fair point. But so I was basically for a while the Evening Standard's political diarist, and my entire job was covering politics, but via the medium of going to parties, going to events, talking to people over a glass of wine, etc. And I kind of found that even though, again, I didn't cover the press conferences or the proper day-to-day stuff that was happening in the chamber, I really felt I had quite a strong grasp on what was actually going on in Westminster. And I guess that's how it all started, because I was like, hang on, I'm meant to only be doing the tittle-tattle and the posh gossip, but actually I really feel I'm in the middle of things and I really understand what's going on and why things are happening and why people take the decisions they do and so on. So political gossip, when I decided I wanted to write a book, always seemed like a very obvious topic to me.
One of the points that you make here is that gossip is, at least in Westminster, a very necessary part of the political system. You know, it's this kind of lubricant, really. At what point were you like, oh, hang on, this isn't just bullshit, this is part of the process?
So again, in around 2015, when I started writing about politics full time, at that point, I'd already been a political nerd for quite a long time. So I followed politics very closely. I kind of knew what was going on. And like I'm sure many, many other people before me, I sort of turned up in Westminster and I was like, I know what to expect. I know how this works. I know how this is going to go. And I sort of turned up and started working there. And I was like, turns out I had no idea how stuff actually worked in politics, what the job of being a political journalist entailed, and what the relationship between MPs and journalists was, or MPs and other MPs, MPs and their staff, etc. Stepping into this world and realising that it was completely different from the way it's portrayed to the outside. And one of the main things actually being the amount of information that flows around Westminster at any given point. So I remember one of the things I found the most shocking at the beginning was actually, again, so the kind of relationship between political journalists and MPs. So I'd always assumed that the way it worked would be, for me as a journalist to say, OK, there's a story I'm trying to work on. I'm going to get MP X to come out for lunch with me, and then I'm going to ask them stuff, and then they're going to tell me stuff. And, that's how it works. It's really not. So, the way it works, and obviously now I've got quite a lot of MPs I count as contacts and actually quite a good relationship with, what happens is that they tell me stuff, I tell them stuff, they ask me to tell them stuff. And it's a lot more two-way as a relationship than I ever thought it would be. So actually, weirdly, as a political journalist, you're entirely part of the information ecosystem. So I've definitely, and I'm sure lots of other journalists have had that as well, kind of called up an MP or a staffer, whoever, to be like, okay, listen, I've heard this, I'm trying to write this story, what have you heard? And they go, what? I had no idea. Hang on, tell me what you know. Oh my God, that's amazing. And it's like, for love of God. So I think, that's how I had, the big realisation.
And I suppose another realisation that some people have been suggesting they've been having, watchers of the Westminster Village, is that this is all new. Now rumour leads everything. There's briefing and counter-briefing. And but for the good old days of politics when it was a much more straightforward operation. I mean, that's completely illusory, isn't it? Well, it's just inaccurate. It's always been like this. Have you tapped in also to the role that this has always played in getting things done?
Oh, yes, entirely. So what I will say is that I think what's changed is that the way the information flows and the way information is used, I think, has not massively changed. What has changed is what actually makes it out of the bubble and what doesn't, and what's kind of weaponized by, willingly being put outside the bubble to voters, to the public or to newspapers, etc. That's partly because of Brexit and because of the general mess. It's partly because of social media. It's partly because of different sorts of people, I guess, have come into Westminster. And yeah, and I'm not sure, because I remember there's one anecdote in the book which I really enjoy from, so I can't remember the name of the shadow minister, awkwardly with a shadow defence minister, I think, under Neil Kinnock at some point, got very, very late and incredibly pissed in one of the bars in Parliament and was chatting to a political journalist and was like, well, you know, I'm going to resign. I can't do this. I disagree with Neil on everything about defence policy. This is like a complete mess. I'm out. And the journalist actually didn't do anything with that and was like, okay, I'm going to let you go home and I'm going to give you a call in the morning and we're going to have a chat and we're going to see what happens. And so, you know, the shadow minister goes to bed and wakes up, presumably with a stonking hangover, and gets a call from that journalist who goes, okay, you're resigning. And he's like, no, I'm not. No, I'm not. And the story never came out. So obviously, you know, it only came out sort of like years and years and decades later. I think that now, if the exact same thing were to happen, either the journalist would probably tweet it out. You know, you don't have the thing anymore of being like, well, anyway, you know, what was he going to do with that piece of information at that point anyway? Because the paper presumably had already gone to print for that day. People would probably tweet it out, or someone would overhear it and tweet it out. You'd chat about it, someone would hear it, put it in a WhatsApp group, and then that make its way to a journalist, etc. So I think information travels a lot more, and also the bar is considerably lower in terms of what actually makes it out of the bubble.
I was really struck at the beginning. You basically outlined the fact that a new MP arriving in Westminster has no real briefing. You know, they've got this mandate from the electorate, but they just pitch up, and it's quite an intimidating environment to land in. No one necessarily has anyone else's best interests at heart. People are pulling in different directions, sometimes for the same thing and so on. And it reminded me of Mary Black. I remember reading an interview with Mary Black, who was at the time the youngest MP to be elected for hundreds of years for the Scottish National Party, saying that weirdly, and it was before all of this stuff had kind of erupted, the best friend that she'd made in Parliament was Jacob Rees-Mogg, who she was ideologically at odds with, but who was very charming and totally personable in real life. And I kind of wondered about how these relationships between press and MPs, between MPs themselves, how unlikely they can be and how they kind of develop.
Very specifically, Jacob Rees-Mogg, there's kind of two points I think I'd like to make. The first one being that there's also quite a sweet story. I feel like calling it a friendship would be a bit too strong, but when Jacob Rees-Mogg had just been elected, so I think either his first vote ever in Parliament, one of his first few votes, he went to vote against his party because he is a rebel at heart. And Sadiq Khan, bless him, who was a Labour whip at the time, saw him and actually stopped him and was like, mate, like, I think you're in the wrong lobby. Like, you know, you should go vote the other way if you're going to vote with your Tories. And Jacob Rees-Mogg like, said, I think, in an interview a few years ago that he'd been really touched actually by this Labour MP who could have just not said anything and let the Tory MP make a fool of himself. But was like, no, hang on, this person is new. And obviously, Jacob was, I know what I'm doing. You know, I am voting with you guys this time. So I think, you know, it does happen. That was not the kind of Mary Black, Jacob Rees-Mogg thing is not necessarily an exception. People can certainly be nice. And the second thing is actually, I was mates with him pre-referendum, quite oddly, you know, because I was working in the Evening Standard Diary. He's quite an obvious diary figure. Like, he always gives a good quote. Yeah, you can go to basically anything he does or listen to anything he says, and it's always full of colour and it's always quite fun. There are so many sort of like quite random relationships within Westminster that are not along party lines or along Brexit lines or along whatever, even though like, actually Brexit, I think, is changing this slightly.
Marie, you mentioned the B word there, not Boris, but Brexit. And you also mentioned in the context of the referendum, this idea of a shift and maybe the impact of Brexit and the rows having a more deep-rooted effect on some of these assumptions and the conventions, the niceties of Parliament and parliamentary procedure and the goings-on in the village. Is that the case? I mean, it's difficult to talk about this because it's such a fast-moving thing. It's so fluid, the situation. But even with your relatively narrow prism window that you've had being right on the inside of this, you suggested that it feels different this time. Why do you think that is?
I think it does. And I think it's a number of reasons. I think one of them is that Brexit has become, like, didn't need to be, but has become a zero-sum game. And you can see that with any sort of deal, any sort of, like, you know, idea to kind of, like, break out of the Brexit deadlock, which is that anytime one side likes something a bit, that means that the other side will automatically like it a bit less. And so in that case, you know, it's kind of hard to find common ground, the same way that, you know, some, let's say, Labour and Conservative MPs can sometimes be, okay, you know, we do need to compromise on this. You know, what can we do that will make all of us happy? And I think on Brexit, that doesn't happen. There's just a lot of anger on all possible sides. And that's not just, you know, like Remain and pro-Brexit. That's within the factions of Remain, within the factions of Brexit, because it is something that's so entirely sort of like life-consuming. And also, there's not that much goodwill left. Like, I think that maybe in a different world, there would have been some goodwill post the kind of 24th of June 2016, but it's not really how it happened. And I do think that a lot of people take it immensely personally as well, in a sort of way that, in a weird way, I'm trying to think of how to phrase this, but I think that in an odd way, you don't quite get with party affiliation. apart from maybe people on the proper right of the Tories and the proper left of Labour, there's normally a bit of an understanding of being like, listen, I disagree with you, but actually I can tell that you genuinely think you're right. You're genuinely trying to make people's lives better. We just disagree on how to go about it. And I think you're wrong. But, you know, I kind of respect where you're coming from, even if I disagree. And I think with Brexit, there's not necessarily that. There's not necessarily that sense of, OK, listen, you know, we disagree, but I see where you're coming from and I think you're trying to help. So it becomes a lot more personal. So it's not just, OK, you know what, we can put the party stuff to the side and go for a drink. There's the thing about going, actually, no, but I personally think you're wrong. And it personally infuriates me that you're doing what you're doing.
And do you think that Parliament and those relationships, have they been informed by the public? Has it to a degree been the other way around? And has this anger, the rage, that sort of intolerance, this very, very strict ideology on this, has that filtered maybe a bit the other way? People have talked about the rhetoric of Parliament having negative real-world impact, if you like, or is it a bit of both, perhaps?
I think it's a vicious circle. I think that the worse Parliament gets, the angrier voters get, and the angrier voters get, the angrier Parliament gets. And you can sort of see that. So normally, like, whenever there's a short recess, especially on the side of pro-Brexit Conservative MPs, of whenever they come back after a few days out of Parliament, if anything, they're more energised and more full of fire for Brexit. Because clearly, you know, they're going to go talk to their association chairman, they're going to talk to the Tory voters in their constituency and kind of come back and be like, no, but genuinely people are furious about this. So, you know, I kind of feel the need to show that fury within the chamber. And then the more people see that, the angrier they get. And again, so I do think that it's kind of a perpetual motion machine at this point, which is worrying. And I'm not entirely sure how you go about stopping it.
Well, that was my next question, which was, please tell me that you've spoken to somebody on the inside of this mad machine who says, don't worry. Don't worry, Marie. Somebody knows what they're doing. There's nobody even pretending to say that, is there?
Oh, no, not a single one. I can say with absolute certainty that I have not spoken to a single person within Westminster over the past few months who's had anything even vaguely optimistic to say about Brexit. Not quite about Brexit, actually, sorry. I'll tweak that slightly, because I think if you talk to certain sort of like proper diehard Brexiteers, they do think there'll be a way out. And
they're clinging on to that.
But yes, and you know, once Brexit is over, everything will be brilliant, kind of like sunlit uplands, etc. But in terms of getting the country back together, no one, and no one has any idea, I think, regarding the way out of how we heal the country. Maybe Rory Stewart.
Rory.
He's just having a nice time.
There we go, listeners. I thought there might be a moment like this during our conversation. On the flip side, then, what is something positive that we can look at? Do we need to look without our board? Should we look to our colleagues in France? You're of French Moroccan by origin, of course. Should we look at Monsieur Macron? He's having a bit of a torrid time. But are there lessons for Westminster from French parliamentarians or anywhere else for that matter?
Not really.
Nowhere. We can't. We've given up looking transatlantic. So we just have to fix this out. What about the next generation, then? This is another conversation which we often have around this table in the Studio One at Midori House, which is, right, we've got a generational problem. It's going to be the people who are watching this madness now coming through the system in 10, 15 years' time. Any bright lights there? Have you seen any promising talents?
Oh, no. So I was going to say, and this is an argument I've made on social media a number of times, so now I'm going to be even more depressing here, which is that I think one of my worries, which I think has been slightly under-discussed, is, to be blunt, who would want to get into politics right now? Who is watching what's going on in Parliament? Who is reading the papers and saying, I want to join the fray?
You're reading your book, Marie. You're not helping.
No, my book's quite
Did that
quite
occur
cheerful.
To you? It's funny. It's very, very funny. But did it occur to you? Were you thinking, oh, I don't know, should I be revealing all of these machinations? Because it's an industry that's, if it's an industry, a profession that's already under enough pressure.
That's quite interesting. Like, I didn't really think about it, to be honest, but one of my best friends, who's a staffer for a political party, said, no, I mean, loved your book, very proud of you, but also you never should have written all of that down. The one rule is that we do not tell people how this works and how messy it actually is.
If you were to write a sequel in, I don't know, what's the time horizon, say 5 years, do you think that a lot of the fundamentals about how it works or doesn't work, the fun elements of the dysfunction, will they be the same? Can they survive the sort of weird political flux that we are in? And in my lifetime of watching Westminster, this seems and feels very different than anything, the upheavals that we've seen before over the last sort of 20-odd years. Can those, the nice elements of it, that friendliness you talk about, this village feel, can that endure the challenges, all of this vitriol, do you think?
I think it will. Also, I would note that I said before we started recording that I would not be making any predictions. So I see you here trying to trick me into making a prediction.
But then you said, and I never will. And that is in itself a prediction of sorts. but just what world would you imagine seeing if you were sat here in 5 years' time?
I'm not sure. I mean, the premise of the book is kind of the fact that actually nothing has really changed over the past few hundred years, apart from, obviously, so I think technology has kind of changed slightly the way people interact with one another, so WhatsApp especially and Twitter to an extent. But apart from that, the fact is that, yeah, Westminster has not changed for so long, and the way people interact with one another and the way things work has not changed in a very, very long time. I don't expect things to massively change. I think what would be really interesting is that, and it's one of the many, many things Westminster should be talking about, but it's not because of Brexit, but Parliament is falling apart, which feels far too on the nose. But you know, so Parliament, people need to leave the building for several years at some point, very, very soon, like preferably yesterday, so it doesn't crumble and sort of like fall into the Thames. When that happens, I'd be really interested to see what happens, and especially if there's a new generation of MPs who maybe get elected and have never known the Palace of Westminster and are only, so I think, Richmond House is the place that's being talked about at the moment, because I think that's why there's an entire, not quite a fifth, but, you know, an entire part of the book is dedicated to the physical spaces in that. So Westminster and SW1, the postcode, like it's a very physical place, and actually the physical spaces and the buildings and the rooms really, really influence the way people behave towards one another. So actually, I would say probably in the next 5 years, the Palace of Westminster will probably have to be vacated and people will have to move somewhere else. And I'd be really interested to see how that impacts the way politics is run.
Thank you, Marie. And haven't you heard? Gossip, Power and How Politics Really Works is out now. You're with The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Being a pop star seems like a dazzling, lavish lifestyle, right? But have you ever wondered how your favourite pop song was written?
I do a lot of writing in the bath with my housemate sat on the toilet taking a photo.
Or who that song was really intended for.
Writing love songs in Spanish, I could say really pathetic, sad things, and it would be a secret from the audience and also from the person that I was writing about.
Join us on The Sessions at Midori House each week, where we bring in a wealth of musical talent to perform live for us and reveal a few truths about making music and keeping your ego under control. Well, sometimes.
I'm unconsciously comparing myself like a jackass to Paul McCartney.
From electropop to indie rock and with plenty of soul to boot, tune into The Sessions at Midori House every Saturday at 8:15 London time for lessons in stardom and a soundtrack to kickstart your weekend.
Immerse yourself in the world of Monocle. Visit monocle.com. Listen live to our radio station, Monocle 24, or explore more than 5,000 hours of audio. Every minute of every show we've broadcast since we launched. And don't forget that we have over 400 films to watch and share, while magazine subscribers can log in and browse our complete print archive on screen. Our online shop is here too, which you'll find well stocked with clothing, books, travel accessories, fragrances, homewares, and more. Check into monocle.com every day for fresh news and opinion from our editors and bureau around the globe. Then plan a trip to one of those spots for business or pleasure with our handy city and resort guides. It's all there for you at monocle.com. What are you waiting for?
You're with The Monocle Weekly, Tom Edwards and Augustin Macellari in the chairs. Org from veritable institution that is Westminster to another institution a little further north, but still here in London, Abbey Road.
Oh, yes.
Abbey Road, just round the corner from us here in North London, is famous not just for its connection to the Beatles, of course, but for the tremendous contribution it's made over many years to the very mechanics of recording music, the music industry itself.
It's a legacy that's being extended through an incubation programme called Abbey Road Red. Through the careful nurturing of startups, it hopes to continue the work Abbey Road has historically done in developing the industry. I caught up with the head of innovation, Karim Fanous, to learn more about how technology is poised to change the way we compose, record, discover and consume music.
Abbey Road Red is our incubation program, our incubator at Abbey Road Studios, but it also kind of stands as a broader umbrella of our other innovation initiatives. My role is to lead the incubation program, and it was started 4 years ago when the team was seeing a lot of kind of innovators out there that were slightly frustrated and trying to do amazing things but hitting barriers, whatever they may be. It might be kind of not understanding quite the ins and outs of the industry and how the value chain works, or it could have just been not being able to meet the right people, or having a great idea but not knowing how to really kind of get it going or get it off the ground. So the team launched the incubator with a view to helping that. But also it was kind of this like amazing pivot point between the incredible history of innovation at Abbey Road and looking to the future, if you like. I mean, stretching back to 1931 when it was completed, Abbey Road was the first purpose-built recording studios complex. And then 2 years later, Alan Blumlein patented stereo and used Abbey Road as the testing ground for his experiments in stereo. And then fast forward through the years and you have the red desks, which many people kind of call the blueprint for the modern recording console, and fast forwarding through the red desk, the TG series of consoles, and then the creation of automatic double tracking by Ken Townsend when John Lennon asked him to kind of try and figure out a way to double track his vocals. There's so many other things as well. That's just scratching the surface. And then the amazing innovation that's happened there as well with recording. I mean, we were just talking about the Beatles and Abbey Road, and, you know, stretch a little bit back before Abbey Road and you had Sgt. Pepper's when they were in there in Studio 2 for 6 months, kind of breaking down the traditional approach to recording with George Martin and the team there, and all kind of together forging a path into the future. So Abbey Road Red, the incubation program, was designed to kind of celebrate that past but also look forward into the future and how we could help introduce the next set of universally adopted technologies into the business like our predecessors did.
I'm really interested by that kind of idea of universally adopted technologies. Obviously the biggest shift that the music industry has undergone over the past sort of 15 years, I guess, is the advent of streaming services, of Spotify and so on. I'm fascinated to know what kind of technologies you're incubating. Has the new Spotify been made yet? Is it out there?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And thinking about this on the way, I don't know if you remember, but like maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago, or maybe 10 now, there was this theory of the celestial jukebox and having every tune accessible in the sky somewhere, and kind of Spotify helped pave the way towards that. And now Spotify, alongside the other streaming services, are really helping provide kind of amazing music and amazing experiences to us as listeners. I don't really think it's about finding the next Spotify. I think it's about finding the next technology that does something like Spotify and other universally adopted technologies have done. And what we're looking at across the value chain is looking at new technologies that help solve problems, whatever they may be. It might be looking at a new way to create music. A good example of that is Vocalea, the microphone technology that we've had the pleasure of incubating. So what George, the founder, is doing with the team there is kind of creating a way of using your voice as a universal instrument. So you make noises into the microphone and it recognizes the noises you're making and translates them in real time using a broad range of approaches, from MIR to translating what you're doing to MIDI, but then also machine learning, getting used to how your voice sounds and getting better at understanding what you're doing. So 1 minute you could be beatboxing, the next second making a trumpet noise, and it'll output that for you. So that's about helping people create music and sounds using their voices. I'm looking at some of the other technologies recently that we've incubated. One startup is called LifeScore, and that's about creating an adaptive music platform that takes human performances and recordings and composition as the foundation, but then creates an evolving music experience that's triggered by data inputs, whatever it is, like changing direction or accelerating or deaccelerating or going up a hill. And it creates these new evolving paths in the music that was recorded by dropping in like a new harmony layer or a new solo layer. And what that's doing that's interesting is combining the human side of things with the technology, the machine side of things, and kind of helping plow that path into the future and the narrative of human with machine rather than one against the other, if you like.
As consumers, what we tend to hear most about what captures the headlines is creative artificial intelligences, whether it's in music or in painting.
Yeah.
You regularly read about, look, this computer painted a picture, it made this composition.
Yeah.
And they're always a bit uncanny. They're never that good. And they always raise this question about whether that's what we want from the future, whether we want machines to be producing our music.
Mm.
But it made me think about, I feel like from more or less the 70s onwards, there was this continuous stream of shifting consumer electronics, you know, at the user's end. Speakers were regularly outdating themselves. There were new media, there was vinyl, there was tape, there was CD, then there's MP3 now, everything's streamed. People were constantly having to rebuy their systems. And I wondered whether this kind of headline-grabbing stuff that's computers making music is actually rather serving to conceal a much richer array of developments that are happening both at the consumer end, but also that are happening maybe in the production end, you know, how we listen to music, how we experience music, rather than just who's making it.
The headlines are important because it brings everything into our discussions and our minds. But you're right, there is a kind of underlying set of paths or journeys that have been taken by founders, labels, other actors in the business, and of course artists at the core, that are really exciting. And you're right, they are pragmatic, almost little steps. A really good example is we went to see Skigger, Benoit Carré's project in collaboration with Francois Paché at Spotify, using his Flow Machines technology. And he's released a new album of kind of traditional recordings or performances, but combining them with the machine learning platform that Flow Machines provides and using it to interpret the performances, but also suggest like underlying chordal structures or other structures. And then Benoit kind of uses them or chops them up or tweaks the system as an instrument and then combines that for the final performance, if you like. And that's a good example of pragmatic steps using this technology, you know. And you alluded to our listening experiences. Yeah, there are loads of kind of subtly introduced pieces of technology, whether it's recommendation technology or kind of startups earlier in the value chain, helping to classify music and understand music in new ways. One of our startups called My Part at the moment is trying to do that. And these kind of new technologies are helping fuel new experiences for us as listeners, and also new possibilities for artists and performers and writers to kind of unearth new possibilities, whether that's a sync placement or helping a publisher find a kind of hidden gem, if you like, or sift through new music and find the gems. They're all, yeah, like you say, these really nice little but constant steps towards enhancing the music industry and our experience of music as an art form.
Spotify has been great for consumers of music. It has famously been less good for artists and redirected funds that maybe artists might have expected to derive from sales or whatever other revenue stream has traditionally held them afloat. And tech does have this sort of vague, I know you incubate rather than accelerate, but it has this vague kind of sense that what's excellent for consumers in the short term has a much wider kind of almost chaos theory impact elsewhere in the industry. So I wonder, you know, when you're thinking about incubating these projects, what sort of steps do you take to kind of safeguard against this potential fallout?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say, to be fair, kind of in my view, there was a lot of disruption that began before Spotify. Mm. And if you like, there was this kind of period of chaos, but actually the industry is rebounding now and revenues are increasing again and payments to artists are increasing and people are trying to get more efficient at tracking where the money's going. And a good example of that actually is one of our current cohort is called Audu, and it's a very beautiful, elegant but simple idea. It's a smart meter that you plug into a wall in kind of small to medium sized commercial establishments or venues, and it listens to the music that's being played, matches it and reports back to the rights holder so that then the correct payouts can be made in real time. So I think there's kind of like also a balance between where technology on the consumption side of things is going and then on the kind of monitoring, reporting and payback side of things is going, and it's catching up now. So I think, yeah, that's one part of what you were saying, I think, that I wanted to respond to. The other side of the question about how do we help safeguard. I like that. It's almost like we're on, I was thinking of this on the way over, or like on the bridge of the Enterprise, right? And kind of we're encountering new cultures and ideas and discovering, and then trying to help share knowledge, but also create this path to the future. But if you kind of take away the abstract down to the practical, we sit in a very special place at Abbey Road Red. It is a long incubation program, not a kind of shorter acceleration program. And we have an incredible kind of network and launch point, and that is the knowledge bank and expertise and our colleagues at the studios. Using that springboard and knowledge base and kind of help network, we can help our founders understand not only their own problems and paths better, but also the problems of the industry. And this is one thing that I found fascinating seeing from the inside at Red, is that how wrong people actually get it when they try and perceive the problems of the industry from the outside. It's really much more complicated, and it can be very difficult inside the industry. So we are able to help them tread their path from the inside. And I think that's how we help perhaps balance this potential beauty and chaos that technology can bring, and help them do things which will help serve music, that whole kind of system from creator to value chain to end listener, in a way that is meaningful.
That was Karim Fanous from Abbey Road Red there, joining Org for the Monocle Weekly.
Well, what a show that was, Tom Edwards.
It was jam-packed with learnings. I always like to alight at a cultural institution of one sort or another, whether we're there to be fascinated, Abbey Road, or to despair, brackets, the Houses of Parliament. Fascinating insights all across the show.
How open are you to technical innovation in your music consumption?
Very much so. I think you need to stay on the crest of the wave. I model my approach to that on Neil Young, who's always said, look, where the music leads, I follow. And you only need to listen to some of his records to realise that he doesn't hold back. But I like that about him.
Didn't he set up his own MP3 platform?
Yeah, it's a
which
new
hosts
way.
Exclusively his music.
It's a new way to consume music that is with total acoustic fidelity.
And he made a profoundly inconvenient MP3
yeah,
player shaped like
about.
A pyramid.
He's fascinated with old cars. He's fascinated with model trains.
Portable vinyl players and pyramid-shaped MP3 players.
You've got to love his approach.
Southern man. Indeed.
He wears his heart on his sleeve, and I like that.
Do you want to say some goodbyes?
Let's do it. Org, thanks to you for producing this programme. Thanks to our studio manager, of course, Maylee Evans. We'll be back at the same time next week with more of the same.
I think it'll be better.
There's only one way to find out. Do tune in. But that's all from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Augustin Macellari.
For this week's programme, thanks for listening.
Goodbye.